This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
The Jodcast studio is our very own Tim O'Brien. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
So today for Ask an Astronomer, we have some very interesting questions. One question from John van Houten was asked through Facebook, and he's been waiting for an answer for about half a year, I think. We sort of missed him out. Our apologies for that.
Well, it's my fault. I'm just too old to be on Facebook.
So John van Houten wonders about interferometry, exactly how it works, but also he read about how they use interferometry these days at optical telescopes, where they bring the beams of light together by mirrors and do the interferometry with the photons themselves. And he wonders if it is possible to, rather than bringing the light together, to record the light from two sources, digitize it, and then correlate them in a computer the same way we do with radio waves. That way you might be able to get around the technical problems you have that limits optical telescopes to go to very large baselines.
Okay, so I mean, this is definitely not a stupid question. In fact, it's quite a deep and complex question, really, if one wanted to go into it in detail. But let me just sort of summarize the background to it, really. The idea of interferometry, the reason for doing interferometry, is that we want to increase the sharpness of view we get with a given telescope. So for any particular telescope, or indeed any sort of optical instrument like your eye, for example, the sharpness of the image that you can create with it is limited by the size of the aperture over which you collect the light. So in the case of the eye, that would just be the diameter of your pupil. For a telescope, it would be the diameter of the telescope. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the sharpness is related to the ratio of the wavelength of light you're collecting and the diameter of the aperture. So it's just really to do with how many wavelengths of light there are across the aperture. So for any given thing, you know, what you want to do to get sharper and sharper image, you would increase the size of your aperture. Clearly that's limited. Your eyes have got an obvious limit. But even for an individual telescope, there's a limit. You can't build telescopes. It's very difficult to build very large telescopes. Now, in the radio, this was a real problem because when we started doing radio astronomy, we're using wavelengths of light which are basically 100,000 times longer than visible light, typically. And that means that to get the same sharpness of view, you'd need a telescope that was 100,000 times larger. So even to get the same sharpness of view as, a 5-centimeter diameter optical telescope with a lens or something 5 centimeters across, you'd need a 5-kilometer sized radio telescope, and right. It's just not feasible. You know, the biggest one there is Arecibo, so that's...
That's 300 meters, yes.
So what the trick was, to take two separate telescopes, separate them by 5 kilometers or something, and then bring the signals back together and combine them. And that's effectively like, you know, you imagine this 5-kilometer sized telescope where you're only using 2 bits of the surface. That's fine. And what you've got to imagine, I guess what I like to imagine Merlin, talk about Merlin here in the UK. Merlin's got 7 radio telescopes spread across 217 kilometres across the heart of England. And you can imagine each of those 7 telescopes as being 7 bits of the surface. And you can imagine radio waves arriving from space and reflecting off those bits of surface. And then they'd sort of come together at a focus. They'd reflect off and they'd come together at a focus. And if this was this giant telescope, the focus would be at the top of a tower that you'd have to build in Birmingham or somewhere, which is in the middle of England. And that tower itself would be, you know, hundreds of kilometres high. So that's mad. So instead what you do is you collect the signal at each telescope and then we transport it across England back to Jodrell to combine it. Now, in the old days when we started doing interferometry, we'd have done these things, this signal's combined live in some way. And when you point the telescopes in different directions, because you're not actually steering a giant dish around, you're not actually tipping a giant dish, you're just steering individual telescopes, what you end up with is a delay between the individual signals from the individual telescopes. So imagine, you know, you've got here your telescope spread across England and you're looking at an object in the sky towards the north or something, at some angle above the horizon towards the north. The radio waves from that source arrive first at the telescope that's at the northern part of the array and arrive a little bit later because of light travel times at the telescopes at the southern end of the array. And we have to correct for that, because if it was a real giant telescope, we'd have tipped it to point in that direction. Yeah. And all these little parts of the dish would all be symmetrically placed. And so that would automatically be allowed for. And in an interferometer, we don't do that. So in the old days, what we'd have done, what was originally done, was to put what are called delay lines, attach separate bits of cable, effectively lengths of cable, that corrected for the delay lengths between the individual interferometer arms. No, in the case of Merlin, we'd need delay lines that were hundreds of kilometres long, so that would be a bad idea. And of course, you have to reconnect to a different length delay line every time you point your telescopes in a different direction. Mm-hmm. So what's done instead is to digitise the signal and send combine those signals back together, correcting for the delay, adding in the delay electronically in the computer. Now, that's done in a thing called a correlator, which is basically a specialized computer that does the digitization and does the adding in the delays and then combining the signals. Now, the question that John had was, why can't we do a similar thing in optical interferometry? And what the good example of an optical interferometer these days is the VLTI, the Very Large Telescope Interferometer over in Chile, which has these, we have these 8-meter sized large telescopes, and then there's these outrigger 1.8 meter telescopes that are the sort of elements, different elements of the interferometer. But they're relatively close together, they're within a space of a few hundred meters on the observing platform at Paranal. And actually they use the delay line idea. So underneath the ground there's actually tunnels, amazing things with almost like little tractor things on wheels that have mirrors on, where the light is sent down the tunnel and reflected off the mirror on this little machine and back down the tunnel again. And if you move the machine up and down the tunnel, you can change the length of the delay line, and that's how that's done.
But that's different from a radio telescope, either whether it's digital or analog, because in a radio telescope, you observe the signal, it's transferred into an electric signal, and that is being transported, delayed, whatever.
Yeah.
And as for an optical telescope, you directly delay basically the photons themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is a difference. So that's called a direct interferometer, when you're directly using the signal that's being produced with the optical interferometer. In the case of the radio, what we do is we digitize it. We sample the signal at a very high rate. And one of the problems you'd have if you tried to do the same thing in the optical is if you can imagine, the frequency at which you'd have to sample the signal is vastly increased over the frequency at which you can sample the signal, you have to sample the signal in the radio. Even in the radio, it's only just becoming feasible to directly sample the signal at sort of gigahertz frequencies. Mm-hmm. Typically what we do is we mix the signal down to low frequencies and digitize it there. So in the case of the optical, one of the problems is you can't sample the signal at a sufficiently high rate, and you get involved in problems to do with basically the particle wave nature of things, where there's only a certain number of photons that you can that you've got to play with. And in the case of effectively most optical detectors that you're used to, CCDs and so on, they detect individual photons. They don't detect the wave, they don't detect this high frequency variation in the signal, which is what we deal with at the radio end of the spectrum. That's basically the crucial thing. It's almost like optical interferometry now is, in a sense, is similar to the way you could do radio interferometry with delay lines in the past. But yeah, you're fundamentally limited by both the variation, the frequency at which you have to sample the signal, and the fact that you've got a limited number of photons to play with.
Yeah, so you can't digitize the wave aspect of a photon. That's an optical telescope.
Yeah, technically it's not possible with an optical telescope. Yeah.
Right. So we have another question from Andrea Ashworth about gravitational waves. Is it possible that we would ever feel stronger effects from a gravitational wave? This means if there was a large event in the universe close to us. I understand they're hard to detect, but if something happens nearby, would it be easier to detect, and would we also notice the physical effects ourselves?
So gravitational waves are these things predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity. So effectively you get sort of ripples in space-time. And in Einstein's interpretation of gravity, it's the geometry of space-time that gives rise to the effect that we perceive as gravity.
I mean, we now believe they actually exist, right?
We do, yeah. I mean, we've never detected them directly yet, mm-hmm. Probably coming in the next few years. We'll get onto that in a minute. But, yeah, we think they exist, largely because of observations of pulsars, as you well know. Yeah. Basically because we see the decay in the orbit of so-called binary neutron stars, two neutron stars orbiting one another, as they radiate away energy via gravitational waves, and the decay in the orbit that you get is exactly what was predicted by Einstein's theory. So we're, you know, as sure as we can be that gravitational waves do exist, but it'd be nice to detect one. And the problem is the effect. The size of the effect is tiny. What if a gravitational wave were to pass? There are gravitational waves passing through us now, we think. But what we would be feeling is that we'd be sort of being squashed and stretched as this wave went through us. Now, the trouble with that is the magnitude of the effect is tiny. For the sorts of sources that we think would give the largest possible signals, we're talking about a fractional stretching or squashing of order 10 to the minus 20. So if something was 1 meter in size, it would reduce in size by 10 to the 20th of that amount. So it's a tiny change. It's a fractional change in the size of something. As I say, 10 to the minus 2 is a 1% change. 10 to the minus 3 is a 10th of 1%. 10 to the minus 20 is a tiny, tiny change. Obviously, if things are closer by, you'll get a stronger signal, but, there is nothing we can think of that's close enough to give us a signal that would be in any way perceivable to us directly. We have to build very sensitive systems. The best sorts of systems that are coming online now, things like LIGO, aims for something like a detection limit of something like 10 to the minus 22, which is smaller than the 10 to the minus 20. So LIGO should be able to detect some of the stronger sources of gravitational waves, and that's why you can say that, we'd hope that in maybe the next few years there'll be a report of the first direct detection of a gravitational wave.
But there's no chance of noticing any physical effects ourselves from gravitational waves?
No, it's just too tiny, I'm afraid.
Okay, well maybe...
Or maybe I'm pleased.
And finally, Paul Duffield sent us an email that around 10 p.m. last night, I sat out in the garden and I looked out into the sky. There was a big, bright orange ball, like there was something on fire. So I rushed in to get my binoculars and looked at the object. It looked at about 32,000 feet, probably more. The object was on fire and it was a dark triangular shape. Was anything reported your end?
Yeah, we do, people often write into us with these sorts of reports. I mean, there was a couple of things. I did reply to Paul actually by email just to give him some feedback on this directly, but just as a general point, I mean, he mentioned seeing a big bright orange ball like there was something on fire. He looked at it on his binoculars and he says it was on fire. I think I started banging on about this a while ago now, in fact there was a recent report here in the UK that somebody else picking up on the same idea, I think actually, that the vast majority of UFO reports we're getting these days are from these so-called Chinese lanterns, which are these
balloons.
Yeah, they're like paper balloons and you light a candle underneath them and it's like a little hot air balloon it rises up. Yeah. So they do look like they're on fire. Mm-hmm. And they're amazing. They are interesting. We've not seen them before. It's a bit surprising. It's no surprise people say there's a UFO, but I suspect if we were living in Southeast Asia or something, there wouldn't be all these UFO reports because they're used to seeing these things.
Sometimes I know they're launched many at the same time, so you see many of these lights floating through the air.
Yeah, often following on from one another because they're all rising from the same back garden somewhere, and they sort of drift up and then they gradually, the wind takes them and then they burn out and they disappear. It sounds very much like that's one of those because of the fire issue. I mean, it could have been a real large hot air balloon, but typically they don't fly them at night.
No.
There is just one other point about this is, one of the things I was saying to him, it didn't sound like it was moving fast. So it wasn't like a fireball, probably. If it's moving slowly, it's much more likely to be a fireball being a meteorite that's burning up in the atmosphere, particularly a large chunk. Mm-hmm. One of the things he does mention is he says it looked as though it was about 32,000 feet, probably more. And, my point there would be, actually, it's almost impossible to tell how far away something is.
Right.
Because you've got nothing to... How can you gauge? You don't know how big it is.
Yeah.
How do you know how far away it is? And, it may feel to you like that's what it's like because if you're comparing it to other things you've seen. But in practice, it could be a lot closer than you think or it could be a lot farther away than you think. And very hard to be sure. But I would say... I'd be 99% sure it was a Chinese lantern.
Yes. I think that's a very clear answer. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And that's it for this month's Ask an Astronomer. And I hope we'll be back next month.
I hope so, yes. We'll see you then.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Tim. And now on to your listener feedback. And first up, we have a postcard from Jason Hill from the Channel Islands. Sent us a very colourful postcard from the Islands of Sark. So thanks for that, Jason.
We've got quite a wall of postcards up here in the Jodcast studio now, so do keep sending them in.
Yeah, I wonder what the furthest one is.
I'm not sure. But it's nice to have something to brighten up the rather grey Jodcast studio.
We've got one with a penguin on. I imagine that's from quite far away.
We have emails from Gillian Parrish and Adrian West. And Adrian tells us about the Newbury Astronomical Society, who hosted a Twitter Moonwatch on a Saturday night. I think that was the 30th of May. And the idea is to have all the members of the Astronomical Society observing the moon or any other nice astronomical objects that we could see that night and Twitter the images. And people are quite keen on receiving those images, and a whole discussion came out as to questions on what the images were about or other astronomical questions, and all night they just went on and Twittered about it.
So there was quite an active discussion going on Twitter during the event, by the sounds of it, with quite a lot of people, yeah, asking questions about the images that were appearing. So it was a very good piece of public outreach by Newbury Astronomical Society.
And we have some of the images, they're on the website, and we'll put a link on the show notes to that website. So speaking of Twitter, we have much activity on the Jodcast Twitter as well. So do join in the discussion, send your tweets around the world.
So in the last edition, we were talking about a list of abbreviations, acronyms, and definitions that's been set up on the forum. And we've had a lot of additions to that since the last episode. I think we've even reached the text limit on the forum for one post. So if you have any questions about anything that we say in the Jodcast that you don't understand, head on over there and we'll try and answer your questions.
So keep sending your feedback. You can do it by going to forum.jodcast.net.
Or if you're on Twitter, you can join us at twitter.com/jodcast.
You can find us on Facebook at jodcast.net/facebook.
And we're on YouTube, youtube.com/jodcast.
Okay, and that's all we have for this month. And in July, as most of the team are actually going to be away, we will probably only have one episode, unfortunately. But we will be back in August with two episodes. So until then, goodbye.
Jod on, people.
Bye, guys.